Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with substitute tech Carlos. Thank you so much.
Good morning.
Carl, the other tech, is away doing field research for school right now, so he won't be here next week, but he'll be back teching for us shortly. Today's program is a real thrill. We're going to be speaking with John Sanbenmatsu, who teaches political philosophy and ethics at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts. He's the author of The Postmodern Prince, Critical Theory, Left Strategy, and the Making of a New Political Subject. And he's also the editor for a forthcoming anthology called Animal Liberation and Critical Theory. And we're going to be speaking about animal liberation and critical theory in particular today and find out what this anthology will contribute to the discussion, where people are going perhaps a little bit wrong in the academy, and how to reinvigorate the left around animal issues. It's a great pleasure to have him on the program. Welcome, John.
Thanks very much, Lauren.
How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great.
Good. So I wanted to ask you a very broad question just to kick things off and find out why you find animal liberation and animal issues so compelling. I always wonder what brings people to the issue. So I know that Peter Singer was an influence of yours.
Yeah. Like many people, I think, who become converted, I suppose, at one point or another in their lives, I always felt an affinity for other animals. My mother was the type of person who would take in wounded birds and that sort of thing, and so I was raised to be respectful of other animals. Of course, we ate them and so forth, but pretty much everybody does. And it wasn't until college when I read, indeed, Peter Singer's book, Animal Liberation. Singer, of course, as your listeners probably know, is a very famous utilitarian philosopher and ethicist, and I read his book Animal Liberation, I think around 1983, and I decided I didn't have a very good reason to continue eating meat at that point. I mean, I was quite convinced by his arguments, and it's been a slippery slope ever since, I mm-hmm. suppose.
Can you tell us a bit about your journey with the academy? I started off my undergrad doing women's studies and anthropology, and there wasn't a lot of room for animals in the way that I was wanting to talk about them anyway. And I think that, you know, there has been shifts in the academy lately, but I'm curious about how you position yourself in relationship to your professional work and what that journey has been like for you.
You know, it's a good question. When I was a graduate student at the University of California, Santa Cruz, I was in an interdisciplinary humanities and arts program, and really I was somewhat tentative in my researches, trying to think about our relations with other animals, and I must say I was not encouraged by my advisors to pursue this line of inquiry, and I was a little too timid, I think, in taking it on more than I did in graduate school. So there's a lot of prejudice and ingrained habit, and what I would call in a way bad thinking, that stifles thinking, theoretical research, and sociological research in the academy on issues involving other animals. In fact, I came up for, I was kind of coming up for my tenure review, not my review, but a meeting prior to my review fairly recently, and some of the feedback I got was that I'm perhaps too concerned with animals. Hmm. And it reminded me of what women encountered in the academy about 20 years ago, 30 years ago, as they began to talk about feminism and women's studies. And as you may know, there's this new burgeoning field called animal studies. It's just getting started. But once you take that leap and you begin to look at the world from the point of view of all the others that we dominate, it just opens up a whole new vista. It's a vista that's quite out of line or out of step with what's considered, in a way, tolerable by mainstream academia.
I was wondering if you could make a bit of an argument for theory in general, because I was really impressed. I was introduced to your work at the Brock conference that happened recently, and I was really impressed by how passionately you spoke about what is happening to animals today in terms of the atrocities that they face, that they have continued to face, that they encounter, all the incredible suffering. And I think that the animal movements really feel a sense of urgency around these issues. And sometimes the academy doing theory can sort of be seen as kind of hand-wringing, you know, while there's major bad stuff going on. Why should we even be engaged with academic pursuits at this point when there is that great urgency to address that suffering?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. And I think that people should have a healthy dose of skepticism toward my work and really anybody who is a paid academic. If you think about the early, very early philosophers in ancient Greece, for example, Socrates had some very harsh words to say about the sophists and others who got paid to do philosophy. And now we have a whole discipline that's emerged, and various disciplines, not just philosophy, of people who are professional writers and thinkers and have certain interest in keeping that going. So I would just, that would be my first comment. That said, you know, theory, at its best, what it does is it sheds light on what we call the totality, which is the whole apparatus of power and domination, social relations, culture, the way it all kind of fits together. And there is, and it does fit together. There are patterns that we can find, that we can look at, patterns in the case of animals, the way we talk about them or dominate them, the patterns that go back centuries and that are implicated with and which overlap with other forms of social domination and oppression. Now, the famous split, of course, is between theory and practice, and those who are on the ground doing the gutsy work of either liberating animals or protesting and so forth, what they do is in many ways more important, perhaps, than what theorists do. On the other hand, if you don't have some kind of broad conception of what the problem is, then it's not really clear that you're going to know the best way to go about solving that problem. And so I do feel passionately that theory has a role to play in social justice movements in general and certainly within the animal rights movement.
One of the things that you point out in this introduction that I got to look over as I was writing actually up the review for the Brock Conference, the introduction for animal liberation and critical theory, you point to the way that theory has addressed the so-called animal question, so how people understand, think about, interact with animals. And you say, you know, it's been dominated, in terms of this question, it's been dominated really by analytic moral philosophy. And you're interested in taking up some other threads to look at that big picture. Can you tell us why? First of all, what are the limitations of analytic moral philosophy for addressing these issues, and why are you interested in different threads?
Well, I think I've learned a great deal from people like Peter Singer, who is indeed one of these analytic philosophers, and Tom Regan is the other major one, of course. So I just want to say first that they have made and continue to make enormous contributions. And I'm not saying that what they do isn't important. But my perspective is as what we call a critical theorist. A critical theorist draws on a tradition of essentially radical political and social thought that dates back roughly to the French Revolution, as well as the 19th century socialists, anarchists, and feminists, and folks who try to develop ways of thinking and also revolutionary practices to alter society at the most fundamental level. Critical theory, as the name suggests, begins from a point of view or a perspective of critique. It doesn't waste too much time trying to prove or show that things are not great. In fact, the starting point of critical theory is that the world is unfree and that human society is, in a way, topsy-turvy. Our values are precisely the wrong values. And those values are not accidental. They derive from a system. Among the different facets of it is capitalism, that system. A system that distorts the human personality and distorts our relations really with the rest of nature, including with the other beings with whom we share the earth. So what I think critical theory has to offer is, as I kind of suggested, first of all, a view of the totality, a view of the whole picture of the way society, economy, culture, ideology, and so forth interact and build up the structure that leads us to be complicit with what I describe as mass murder or atrocity committed against the other creatures of the earth. And that's, I think, its value. It's not to say that we don't also need, you know, wonderful moral philosophers helping us to think about our duties, moral duties to other animals, but that without a radical critique of, say, capitalism, we're missing a big part of the picture, because what keeps things going, the reason that so many tens of billions of animals are going to be killed in the next 12 months is not simply because people aren't thinking the right way about moral philosophy, right? It's because there's a huge profit motive that keeps the juggernaut in motion. And it's from that profit motive that much of the ideology follows.
Mm. I am interested in hearing more about your understanding of humanity in terms of coming up with this more grand picture of how things function, and then therefore how people intervene, have intervened effectively and can intervene effectively. Is it a problem of humanity per se? Is it certain strains within humanity, those who have developed capitalism, you know, for example? How do you relate to that question of, is it human beings really sort of at their core that are at fault, or is there something else going on here?
Well, it's a very complicated question. I'm not sure I have a definitive answer to it. You know, obviously, society, by definition, is a construct. It's something that we can change, and therefore, human beings are not, you know, in no way fated to dominate either one another or other animals. Hindus and Buddhists and others have been vegetarians for many centuries, for example. And if you look at the progress we've made as a species in the last century in terms of international human rights norms and laws and so forth, there certainly is hope that we can change who and therefore, in a way, what we are. There's a great deal of debate among theorists about the extent to which we human beings have an essence meaning something sine qua non, something that makes us who and what we are, that transcends particular historical epochs and cultures and so forth, something that's unchanging. And my kind of objection to what's called post-structuralist theory is in part that there's an assumption that we don't have any essence whatsoever. But of course we do have an essence, because I can't just extend my arms and fly off of my porch. We have certain built-in limits, or what the French philosopher Sartre called facticity. You know, we have certain facts about us that we can't deny. What those facts are, though, is going to be in perpetual dispute. Now, we do, to get back to your original question, we do have a natural basis within us for aggression, and I think a death drive, thanatos. And we also have eros. We also have a dimension of erotic love and sensuality and so forth. And those are part of our personality. Well, it seems that we developed as predators, you know, eons ago. That's part of our biological equipage. But it doesn't mean that we have to continue being predators, either towards one another in Iraq or, you know, towards these gentle creatures that we lead to the slaughterhouse.
Would you say, though, that your critiques are primarily directed towards sort of a Western dominant framework? I mean, you use the expression or the term society a lot. Does that extend beyond what people do critique as the sort of the Western dominant paradigm?
Well, the Western dominant one, I mean, my, you know, like others, I suppose I'm lamentably Eurocentric, because I tend to critique, indeed, the Western paradigm. The Eastern paradigm isn't that much better. In certain ways. For example, Buddhism is, well, one of the most important of the five precepts is not to harm any living thing, and that is head and shoulders above anything that we have in the Western tradition. However, even Buddhists, some Buddhist cultures are pretty brutal towards other animals, and so there is a problem with human civilization and society as such, I think. I mean, there's no question that that kind of this brutality, remorseless killing of other beings, other sensitive beings, extends throughout every culture. But the Western paradigm is the one that is dominant around the world at the moment. That may change. You know, it's Western culture that's consumed throughout the world, that's imposed on other cultures in the third world. So I think that may be one reason I and others concentrate on it.
Can you give us a bit of an introduction to the left and why the left has failed to really address, at least recently in a concerted way, the animal question and animal exploitation. What's going on there? I mean, in terms of the violence, the wars, etc., oppression, you know, there has been, of course, various different movements that have been very interested in challenging and resisting that. But the animals, in terms of recent history anyway, are still falling very far behind in terms of those politics. What's going on there?
That's a really good question. Back in 1989, I wrote a piece for Z Magazine, which is a leftist kind of magazine in the United States, called The Animal Rights of the Left. And indeed, nothing much has changed since then. Most leftists are quite dismissive of any mention of animal rights, and the reason has to do ultimately with the genesis or the origins of leftist or critical thought, which, as I said, kind of usefully date back to the French Revolution, 1789, and the Declaration of the Rights of Man, which came out of the French Revolution. That revolution and the American Revolution as well were humanistic. They were secular, and it was seen to be great progress that the human individual was being, in a way, ennobled and given a kind of inherent dignity and inviolability. And that's the very notion of having human rights, right, mm-hmm. derives from that period. So the emphasis from the beginning was on Homo sapiens, of course, and democracy and liberty and brotherhood, and that was defined in anthropocentric terms. So that's the origins of the tradition. Now, as you may know, and your listeners may know, in the 19th century, there were socialists and liberal reformers and feminists who were very sympathetic to animal rights issues and did work in multiple arenas. Henry Salt, of course, who was a scholar on Shelley, as well as a social reformer, wrote some books on animal rights. This is the late 1800s. And even before that, going back the previous century in England, there were people concerned with what we would call leftist causes, for example, prison reform or trying to get children out of the mines, in other words, child labor laws enacted and so forth, who were also interested in enfranchising animals or enacting animal welfare laws. So now, to just kind of fast forward to the present, I mean, look, we're in a huge global crisis that has so many dimensions to it, ecological, economic, social, political. We have the United States enacting an incredibly aggressive foreign policy, an imperialist foreign policy. You know, we've got billions of human beings dying or living in dire poverty. I think it's 30 million children, human children, die every year in the third world. So, of course, folks who are concerned about war and poverty and oppression, they have their hands full. And beyond that, like ordinary people, many leftists share the prejudice that, well, look, we've got to take care of our own first. And that kind of parochialism is often expressed nationalistically in other contexts, right? So before we help the tsunami victims in Indonesia or wherever, we have to take care of our own. We should feed our own kids in the inner city, and so forth. But viewed from another perspective, the animal liberationist movement is part of this larger movement for justice and freedom and for an end to unnecessary suffering. And to me, it's short-sighted for folks who are concerned with human rights or overcoming oppression in other contexts to ignore what is arguably the greatest oppression that we have of our time, which is the enslavement of quite literally tens of billions of other animals. So it is lamentable, but it's not the case that all leftists take this line. And one of the things I'm doing in my book, this edited collection, is showing that there are some leading academic theorists who describe themselves as Marxist or socialist or feminist who are unabashedly in favor of our taking on, you know, human domination.
I have a follow-up question to that.
Sure.
Talking about the left, I wonder if you can weigh in on the right and how, I think it's Matthew Scully, Dominion, he used to be a speechwriter for Bush. How do you make sense of, or what do you think about the right, to the extent that they've taken up the animal question and are interested in issues of animal welfare and animal rights?
Well, there are Scully's more the exception that proves the rule, I'm afraid. You know, it's interesting. There's a professor at Brock, John Sorensen. I don't know if John's been on your show.
But yeah.
He's written an interesting paper that I'm hoping to have in my volume on the way that the left and the right come together in demonizing the animal rights movement, which is quite true. That said, the political right has always been, you know, from the time of the French Revolution to the present, has always been allied with the most powerful interests in society. And today, the most powerful interests in society are the pharmaceuticals, agribusiness, the meat industry, dairy industry, and so forth, among others. And so the right is generally even more hostile than the left towards animal liberation, because it's seen as a fundamental threat to capitalism, to a free market economy. And more than that, it's touched a raw nerve among evangelicals, Christians, which is, you know, who are a resurgent kind of movement in my country, the United States. It's touched a raw nerve among those folks who see it as an attempt to place Darwin, right, and Darwinistic kinds of thinking over religious scripture. And nothing gets these people more upset than the notion that they are descended from apes.
Mm.
And this is part of the general ideology. We have to place other animals on the other side of this divide by denying our own animality. We can't, it's too much for us to think about, you know, the commonalities and continuities we share with our biological kin. But at any rate, for the far right, there are these business interests, essentially, and then the religious concerns that make them even more implacably hostile. Matthew Scully is courageous for coming out to take his position, but in general, the right is a kind of pro-domination movement, and it's very much in favor of continuing hierarchies of men over women, of whites over blacks, even though they don't say that, but that's implicit in their opposition to all civil rights laws, and similarly, the domination of humans over non-humans.
We're going to do a little break. We're going to have some ads, but I wanted to come back and hear about your argument regarding, you said that animal liberation is not merely another critical theory, but really it's the primordial critical theory, and I want to hear more about that. So please stick around, and we'll come back in a few minutes. Hello, and welcome back to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM, www.ciut.fm over the internet. I'm your host, Lauren Corman. Today's interview, we're speaking with Professor John Sanmunbatsu, and we're talking about critical theory, the left, animal liberation, and a whole bunch of other things as well. People might know John from his book, The Postmodern Prince, Critical Theory, Left Strategy, and the Making of a New Political Subject. I assume you probably got some negative reviews of that book, but the ones that I read overwhelmingly were glowing. So that was obviously a very celebrated text.
Well, why don't you send those to me? That'll cheer me up, definitely.
Everyone that I read over the past couple of days have been extremely positive. I want to hear more about critical theory and this upcoming anthology that you're editing. And as I had mentioned before the break, you say in the introduction that animal liberation is really not merely another critical theory. It's the primordial. The argument can be made it's a primordial critical theory. Can you explain that?
Yes. If we think about critical theory, as I said, as a perspective that starts from the point of view of the world being unfree, and if we work backward from the different kinds of social oppression that we see, racism and sexism, the domination of workers by a kind of parasitical master class, and so forth, what we find historically, I mean, going back in time, is that so much of human social oppression has been modeled on and derived historically from human domination of other animals. The invention of, if we can call it an invention, the invention of animal agriculture and techniques for confinement of animals perhaps 10,000 years ago became the model for confinement of human beings and provided a model and a language for talking about human beings as slaves. In fact, a slave was originally called a two-footed animal. I can't remember if, what I think this was among the Greeks. At any rate, so that's the first thing, is that what we do to other animals and the way we do it, the way we talk about doing it, became the model for enslaving, say, black Africans. It continues to be a model for the way that men talk about women. Carol Adams, a feminist theorist, has written a great deal about this. Your listeners might want to check out her book, The Sexual Politics of Meat. You know, we talk about women as, not we, but society talks about women as objects, sexualizes them, but also animalizes them. So there's first of all that, just the many rhetorical, what we would call representational parallels between the degradation and abjection of non-human others and then the turn towards using those techniques and that language vis-a-vis other groups of human beings. But so much of our society is, in fact, based on this distinction between the human and the non-human that that's really also another part of why I say it's the primordial critical theory, animal liberationism. Because what is it, if I ask my students, say, what does it mean to be human, you know, most of the things that they will say are intended to mark us out and apart from all the other species on the earth. In a direct sense, to be human means to be not animal, mm-hmm. right? It means to privilege the mind and reason over the body and feeling and so forth. And the way that our society is organized, so much of it economically, has to do with the domination of other animals. Folks who are vegan, and I'm a vegan, know that it's almost impossible to buy any product, you know, a cosmetic or food or anything that doesn't have the body, some aspect of the body of another animal incorporated into it. I read somewhere that the second largest industrial concern in the United States after automobiles is animal slaughter. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that this distinction that we draw, the lines that we draw between the human and the non-human, end up structuring the economy, culture, language, in ways that are indeed primordial or prior to so many other social problems. Now, that said, it's not as though if we just stopped killing and dominating other animals, then, say, there would be no racism. It's not as clear as all that. However, I don't think that there's any hope, myself, of us solving, you know, problems having to do with war and the killing of human beings by other human beings, until and unless we confront the normalized violence that we inflict on the bodies and minds of other animals day by day by day. One of the early critical theorists, Theodore Adorno, who was a philosopher with what we call the Frankfurt School, in the 1940s, said that Auschwitz begins when someone looks at a slaughterhouse and says they're only animals. And what Adorno was doing was drawing a direct parallel, of course, between the way we treat other animals and the way the Nazis treated the Jews and other groups in Germany in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And the implication being that if you can look at some group of sensitive beings and mercilessly consign them to some horrible fate or indifferently do so, it's not going to become a very good basis for social relations with your own kind.
You talk about this term, I'm sure, is going to make some people roll their eyes, but you talk about subjectivity, which is something I'm really interested in as well. And I want to hear more about that, because you talk about how what is being reclaimed is really the reclaiming of the subjectivity of animals. And this relates to what you were just saying, in the sense that people might think, okay, you know, we are doing these various things to animals. You know, I agree of sort of the material facts of the matter, but that their subjectivity, how they experience, know, perceive the world, is somehow less rich than ours, and therefore of less consequence. How do you address that, those sorts of concerns?
You know, many people are addressing those concerns, among them scientists who are devising just extraordinarily ingenious experiments, both in the lab and in the wild, just through observation and interaction, to delve into the consciousness of beings who are both similar to us and radically dissimilar to us. They're quite different. And the more that scientists look into it, the more extraordinarily rich, I should say, their inner lives and worlds become. There's this the parrot Alex, who's used in experiments. You know, and I must say that I don't agree with confining animals in labs and even conducting nonviolent experiments on them. But at any rate, some of the data that's coming out is worth talking about. At any rate, Irene Pepperberg is an academic who has Alex, and Alex is a parrot who can speak in English to some extent, and you can ask Alex to identify different objects, and he can tell you if something is made of wood or whether it's made of rubber and how many corners it has and so forth. And what we're finding is that consciousness occurs completely across the phylogenetic spectrum. It isn't limited to primates. We have had this assumption, which is really just an ideology or prejudice, that any animal who could remotely be like us must be an ape, because we're 98-99% genetically identical to chimpanzees. So they must be the smartest ones on the block after us. Well, in fact, that's not true. You know, dolphins and sea lions and birds, octopi, all have intelligence, and quite complex intelligence. Pigeons outperform human beings on some aspects of the standardized IQ test, in terms of conceptual reasoning, abstract manipulation of objects, and so forth. So what critical theory wants to do, I think, is part of this general movement in society, not just science, but in popular culture as well, this movement to reveal the experiences, bring to light the experiences and richness of other animals' lives. What critical theory can do is, first of all, deconstruct or take apart the different bad ideas out there that have kept us from seeing what has been beneath our noses all this time. In other words, what critical theory can do is to pull back some of the layers of deceit, self-deceit, the lies that we've told about ourselves as well as about other animals, and look at that historically and culturally and so forth. The other thing is that critical theory ultimately is a defense of the subject meaning the perceiving, feeling, thinking being in the world. And we like to think we're such a subject, and I think we are, but we're not the only ones. And we're finding that the world is full of such subjects. So critical theory, as I've kind of implied here, is part of this reclamation project. Maybe you use that word too, to uncover what's been hidden, which is the value of these other experiences and ways of looking at the world. And they're just as, and I just want to add, and yep, they're just as rich as ours. I mean, all the evidence seems to be pointing in that direction. We think, well, if somebody feels a pain or suffers loneliness or depression, as say a human being, if we try and imagine that in another animal, it must be kind of like it maybe, but it's not going to be as intense or it's not going to be as meaningful an experience for them. But on the contrary, because we're such good abstract thinkers, we can be very distanced from our bodies and feelings, and we may not even feel things as keenly, say, as a dog or a cat or a stingray might. They are incredibly sensitive beings, not just physiologically, but emotionally.
Mm. I wanted just quickly to ask about ecofeminist theory, because it seems to me that that's sort of another realm of social and political theory. I'm sure some people would call it critical theory, that has not strictly taken up analytic moral philosophy as its sort of entry point into the conversation. But people like Karen Warren or Greta Gard, Vandana Shiva, people like this who have tried to bring together different issues of oppression together and to think about the subjectivity of animals, their own experiences of the situation, however unfolding. I'm wondering where they figure into, and or if they figure into your understanding of critical theory, and where they are, if anywhere, within the upcoming text.
Yeah, I'm really glad you said that. Because I should have mentioned them sooner. They've been the pioneers in a lot of ways of what I would describe as a critical theory of animal liberation. I mentioned Carol Adams earlier, and you mentioned Greta Gard and some others. There's also Josephine Donovan. folks who have been making, as you say, a number of connections between how we relate with and dominate other animals and, say, the way men dominate women, and giving us an analysis of patriarchy on a global scale and the way that this global structure ends up structuring our perceptions and ordinary interactions on a daily level with one another. And I think it's quite important and significant. And in many ways, it's the most complete critical theory that we have to this day in terms of making sense of society and making sense of our natural relations. So I have a great deal of respect for ecofeminism. We have, in this volume I'm putting together, I mentioned Carol Adams and Josephine Donovan. They're going to be contributing something. And also Catherine MacKinnon. Catherine MacKinnon, of course, is not an ecofeminist, but she's a very well-known radical feminist legal scholar in the United States who has, you know, been most famous for her work against pornography and the pornography industry. And she has a piece, it's actually a reprint of a piece of hers that appeared in another volume called Of Mice and Men. So a feminist perspective, it seems to me, is quite crucial for making sense of it all because, as I indicated earlier, women are treated as animals in pornography and in mainstream society. They are exoticized. They are reduced to commodities for consumption, for male consumption. Occasionally, they're even butchered and cut up the way other animals are, right? Serial killers, we think, well, they're just an anomaly. They're just freaks and so forth, but serial killers happen, are disposing of women throughout the world all the time, and it's something that's almost become normal. Meanwhile, you have mainstream films like the Saw films or Hostel, films that my students are going out to see that have to do with the torture and dismemberment of women, and that symbolic dismemberment is going on at all sorts of levels in a society. In terms of violence against women. But also, who's the other group in society who are occasionally cut up into pieces? Well, other than women, it's animals. It's other animals. That's a long-winded answer, but the answer is yes. Ecofeminism is crucial to understanding what's going on.
I'm just wanting to reflect a little bit about on feminism and ecofeminism and its contribution. Do you see room within that contribution for dissenting voices within feminism itself, third wave feminism, whereas, for example, we've had people identify as prostitutes and sex workers and also people involved in the pornography industry on the show, as well as people like Greta Garde and Carol Adams, but those people saying, you know, being involved in pornography for me is about reclaiming my body, reclaiming my sexuality, interacting on my own terms. Yes, I want good labor conditions, and yes, I want to be able to have a say in how this material is distributed, but they're coming from a different perspective, and they're identifying as animal liberationists. Mm-hmm. Is there also room for them within this kind of framework?
Is there room for them? Well, they're certainly entitled to their perspectives, and one should always, you know, respect and listen to what other people have to say. In my opinion, it's really barking up the wrong tree, theoretically and in terms of a politics, because that so-called pro-pornography feminism, which I think of as a kind of oxymoron myself, is coming out of a strain of, as you say, third-wave feminism and theory that is extremely libertarian. And the problem with the libertarian outlook, there are many problems with it. One is vis-a-vis animals. Well, look, you have your lifestyle and I have my lifestyle. And who's to say which is better? You like to eat meat, I don't like to eat meat. So you do what you want to do and I'll do what I want to do. It can be reduced, I think, to that kind of a position. The other problem is that by accepting the commodification of women's sexuality, we give away too much. That's my opinion. In the same way that people who say, well, look, the fact is, realistically, we're never going to do away with tormenting and confining and killing other animals, so let's work on some reforms. Let's just give the cows a little bit more pasture. Let's instead of having 10 chickens to a battery cage, let's have 2. A kind of reformist and liberal outlook. And I do think that the libertarian pro-porn position is ultimately kind of a liberal position. So to answer your question, you know, people come to animal rights, as you've noted on this program, from a conservative point of view sometimes, even a religious point of view. But from a critical theory point of view, which is, after all, concerned with liberating everybody, not just other animals, I have a problem with, and I think we all should have a problem with, positions that accept male domination or try to accommodate to male domination. And if you look at pornography, you know, 90% of it is about the degradation and humiliation of women.
I know we could do a whole program on that. So I know that was kind of
agree with me.
It's a bit of a curveball that I threw you there, and I know that we could go into it more, but I did want to address it.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, we just have about 5 minutes left, and you can take this in any direction that you want. I was curious for you to give your sort of 2 cents. I know there's much more than that on the animal movements right now as they stand, and any last words that you wanted to share with our listeners. We'll definitely have you back on the program if you're up for it.
Of course, I'd be delighted to, if I haven't bored half your audience to death.
Okay.
I think it's great that you have this program. There are folks who are listening, and it gives me some hope that there are programs like this out there. It's such a I find it a very difficult issue to take on and to take seriously, and I'm sure anybody who has ever had any sympathies for the plight of other animals feels the same way, because it doesn't seem as though the movement is having much of an impact. And I should give a rah-rah speech here, I suppose, about how we should just keep our chins up. And one could point to, and should point to, different moments in the past when movements seem to be defeated or seem to not be making much headway, and then, of course, change happens. And so you just have to keep doing that, regardless of the odds. The fact is, however, this is an extremely difficult time to be an activist in any, you know, in any venue, because religious fundamentalism, Hindu, Jewish, Christian, Islamic, are all on the rise everywhere. The earth is embattled. Global warming is a catastrophe for the animals of this earth. The biosciences and biotechnology enterprise is, it's hugely well funded, and they're investing billions of dollars in counter propaganda to defeat animal rights issues. Animal rights activists are being branded terrorists and so forth. So I guess, you know, I believe in what the Italian theorist Antonio Gramsci, after someone else, I can't remember who, called a pessimism of the intellect and an optimism of the will. We have to remain optimistic that things can change, but we also have to be realistic and realize that these are very long odds that we're up against, and we just have to keep doing what we can and informing listeners, as you're doing, that this is an issue that is not simply a charity concern or a peripheral issue. It goes to the very heart of our civilization, and anyone who's interested in human freedom has got to be interested in the freedom of all creatures, because they're not mutually exclusive, and in fact they're intertwined.
We have here just about 3 or 4 minutes left. Can you comment on a strategy or two? I mean, you're very interested in strategy. Can you tell us about what some things you think are useful that have been going on and that potentially will be useful in the future for the animal movements?
Oh dear. I honestly, I can't say that I have much to say about that. I do think, kind of on a negative note, I do think that people blowing up things and vandalizing, well, not so much vandalizing property, I suppose it's threatening people and so forth, which has been a controversial tactic used by the direct action wing of the animal rights movement. I do think that that sort of thing is very much not helpful. One could argue about whether it's morally justified, because, of course, the suffering and the oppression that are taking place are so horrific and beyond imagining that it's very hard to say that any tactic is, just on the face of it, something that we should reject. But I just think politically and strategically that sort of thing is not helping the movement at all. Because ultimately, the only way society is going to be changed is not through force, but through some form of persuasion. And certainly confrontation is part of that persuasion. But, that's more of a comment about certain tactics that I think are unhelpful. I wish I could say that I had a master strategy for solving this.
That's
one,
okay.
But I don't. Yeah, I don't.
Yeah, nobody I've talked to so far has a master strategy. So we really appreciate you being on the program.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, it was.
And I look forward to your book coming out. When is it coming out? The Animal Liberation and Critical Theory.
Hopefully next year, 2008.
Okay, great. Well, we'll definitely have you back on the program again.
Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you so much, John. You've been listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. We were just speaking with Professor John Sanbun Batsu, and we were talking with him about critical theory and animal liberation. And if you're interested in hearing this program, you can go, again, you can go to our website, animalvoices.ca, or write us animalvoices@gmail.com if you have any questions or comments. Thank you so much to Carlos for teching. Please stay tuned for Roadrunner.